Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 16. We're going to start with text 15, and which has no purport. No, actually, it's a short purport. And I'm going to read that and a few other verses which have either no purport or another short purport, and then we'll chant text number 19 together. Okay, so I'll just chant this myself, and when we get to 19, then we'll all do it together. Tasmarisha bhajantyame. Okay, well, it's Kali Yuga, so you got to say it three times. We'll say it again. So, text number 15 is a very short purport, so I'm going to just chant it myself. Okay? And then when we get to 19, we're going to chant that together. Okay, so here we go. Try it again. Tasmarisha bhajantya me. Did we catch somebody there? Anyway, it's okay. Shreyas chintaya suvrata rita shriya ritashtana sapatnai patina prabhu. This is translation. Therefore, most gentle Lord, kindly favor your maidservant. We have now been deprived of our opulence and residence by our competitors, the demons. Kindly give us protection. Purport. Aditi, the mother of the demigods, appealed to Kashyapa Muni to give the demigods protection. When we speak of the demigods, this also includes their mother. Prabhupada's being a little facetious there. Text 16. Pararvivasita shaham magna vyasana sagare aishvaryam shriya yashastanam ritani prabalar mama. Translation. The demons, our formidable, powerful enemies, have taken away our opulence, our beauty, our fame, and even our residence. Indeed, we have now been exiled, and we are drowning in an ocean of trouble. Yatatani pana puna sadho papadyeran mamat maja tata vidheha kalyanam diya kalyana kritama. O best of sages, best of all those who grant auspicious benedictions, please consider our situation and bestow upon my sons the benedictions by which they can regain what they have lost. Sri Sukhavacha evam abhyartito ditya kastam aha smayaniva aho maya balam vishno sneha badam idam jagat. Sukadeva Goswami continued, when Kasyapa Muni was thus requested by Aditi, he slightly smiled. Alas, he said, how powerful is the illusory energy of Lord Vishnu by which the entire world is bound by affection for children? Short purport. Kasyapa Muni was surely sympathetic to his wife's affliction, yet he was surprised at how the whole world is influenced by affection. And now we'll chant this one responsibly. This is text number 19. Qua deho bhautiko natma. Qua deho bhautiko natma. Qua chatma prakrite para. Qua chatma prakrite para. Kashyake pati putradya. Kashyake pati putradya. Moha eva hikaranam. Moha eva hikaranam. Qua deho bhautiko natma. Qua chatma prakrite para. Kashyake pati putradya. Moha eva hikaranam. Others.
Vaishnavis.
Qua, where is Deha, this material body, Bhautika, made of five elements, Anatma, not the spirit soul, Qua, where is Cha, also, Atma, the spirit soul, Prakrite, to the material world, Pada, transcendental. Kasya, of whom? Ke, who is? Pati, husband. Putra adya, or son, and so on. Moha, illusion. Eva, indeed. He, certainly. Karanam, cause. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Kasyapa Muni continued, what is this material body made of five elements? It is different from the spirit soul. Indeed, the spirit soul is completely different from the material elements from which the body is made. But because of the bodily attachment, one is regarded as a husband or son. These illusory relationships are caused by misunderstanding. Purport. The spirit soul, Atma or Jiva, is certainly different from the body, which is a combination of five material elements. This is a simple fact, but it is not understood unless one is spiritually educated. Kasyapa Muni met his wife, Aditi, in the heavenly planets, but the same misconception extends throughout the entire universe and is also here on earth. There are different grades of living entities, but all of them are more or less under the impression of the bodily conception of life. In other words, all living entities in this material world are more or less devoid of spiritual education. The Vedic civilization, however, is based on spiritual education, and spiritual education is the special basis on which the Bhagavad Gita was spoken to Arjuna. In the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna instructed Arjuna to understand that the spirit soul is different from the body. Dehinosmin yata dehe komanam yovanam jara tata dehantara praptir diras satranamuyate. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. Bhagavad Gita 2.13. Unfortunately, this spiritual education is completely absent from modern human civilization. No one understands his real self-interest, which lies with the spirit soul, not with the material body. Education means spiritual education. To work hard in the bodily conception of life, without spiritual education is to live like an animal. Just in case you didn't already realize it, this is like a classic Srila Prabhupada, you're not this body purport. You know, they're scattered throughout the books, and this is like a super classic, you know, we're not this body purport. And you're hearing all the, Prabhupada's making all the points, you know, the main points he usually makes along with that, you know, to establish that. So, yeah. Anybody who's to work hard in the bodily conception of life without spiritual creation is to live like an animal. Nayam deho deha bhajan nirloke kastan kaman arate vidbhujanye. Bhagavatam 5.5.1. People are working so hard simply for bodily comforts without education regarding the spirit soul. Thus they are living in a very risky civilization. For it is a fact that the spirit soul has to transmigrate from one body to another. Tata dehantara prapti. Without spiritual education, people are in dark ignorance and do not know what will happen to them after the annihilation of the present body. They are working blindly, and blind leaders are directing them. Andaya tandaya upaniyamanas te pisha tantriyam urudamni bada. Bhagavatam 7.5.31. A foolish person does not know that he is completely under the bondage of material nature, and that after death, material nature will impose upon him a certain type of body, which he will have to accept. He does not know that although in his present body he may be a very important man, he may next get the body of an animal or tree because of his ignorant activities in the modes of material nature. Therefore, the Krishna consciousness movement is trying to give the true light of spiritual existence to all living entities. This movement is not very difficult to understand, and people must take advantage of it, for it will save them from the risky life of irresponsibility. Maam Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tanamane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharane Navashesha Sanyavadi Paskacharishtarne. So, in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, towards the end, Arjuna asks Krishna a question. He says, Stita pragyashaka basa samadhi stasya keshava stita di kim prabhasita kim vrjeta kim asita vrjeta kim. He said, what are the symptoms of a person whose consciousness is merged in transcendence? How does he speak? What is his language? How does he sit? And how does he act? How does he sit and how does he walk? Like that. So, and Krishna answers him. He says, Prajahati yadakaman sarvan parthamanogatan atmani eva manatushta stita pragyasta dochade. That he says, when a person, how's it going? Yeah, when a man gives up all varieties of sense desire, thank you, which arise from mental concoction, and his mind finds satisfaction in the self alone, he's said to be fixed in transcendental consciousness. So the point is, Krishna doesn't immediately directly answer Arjuna's question, because Arjuna was asking, how does he speak? What is his language? How does he sit? And how does he walk? And Krishna, at least in his immediate answer, the first part of his response, doesn't say anything about those things. He doesn't tell him how he speaks, what his language is, how he sits, and how he walks. But he gets right to the essence of the whole thing, which is that he tells Arjuna that, you know, when a person is no longer... How's it going? Stop me off again. Yeah, when a man gives us... Thank you. When a man gives us all varieties of sense desire, which arise from mental concoction, sarvan partham anogatan. That's the point. See, that's the point that Krishna chooses to address. Arjuna's asking him a question, and Krishna kind of understands, you know, the gist of it, and he's giving him the essence right away in his answer, that a person who gives up all varieties of sense desire, and the next phrase is the really important phrase, sarvan partha manogatan, that all of these varieties of sense desire, they arise from mental concoction. They just arise from mental concoction. And so that's the first step. That's the most important thing, that a person has to give up all varieties of sense desire which arise from mental concoction. Now, there's all these material desires. They're nothing to do with the spirit soul, nothing to do with our real life as eternal servants of Krishna. And somehow or another, you know, we're taking shelter of mental concoctions. Rather than the statements of the Shastra, we're taking Shabda Brahma, we're taking shelter of some idea, some mental concoction. You get absorbed and you get this idea like, I think I'll be happy like this. You see? And then you take shelter of that, you try to act upon it, and then even it becomes more than just an idea. It becomes like once you make the choice to take shelter of it, then it's a mental reality, and then it translates eventually into a physical reality. Give an example, like somebody who, say, thinks at some point in their life, they think, you know, I think I'd like to smoke. Okay, so they start smoking. And it's just like, initially it's just a mental concoction, you know, it's a mental concoction, material desires which arose from a mental concoction. I think I'll be happy, I think I'll look cool if I smoke. You know, I can cut a profile and I'll look cooler and I'll attract people of the opposite sex or same sex or whatever the case may be. And so it's also just like it's a mental reality. You know, I'm smoking, I think it's cool. But then because it becomes a physical reality and that, you know, you become addicted to the nicotine and everything. And then when if you try to stop smoking after some period of time, you've actually experienced physical symptoms. You know, it's difficult. You feel uncomfortable in various ways, and it becomes actually hard to stop smoking, you see? And then you're dealing with a physical reality. But to start off with it, all it was you know, just a mental concoction. Is it, you just had this idea, you just took, this idea pops in your head that, yeah, I think, if I smoke, I could look cool, that could be a good idea. You know? So it just starts off as a mental concoction that you take shelter of, but then it becomes a physical reality. Same thing with drinking or taking drugs or so many different things. See, it starts off just as an idea, a thought, which is bogus, you know, which is not Shabda Brahma, which is not Shastric, and you misuse your minute free will, the minute independence, you take shelter of it, you think this is a good idea, rather than seeing it through Shastra Chakshus, the eyes of the scriptures, and understanding it's not a good idea, reject that stupid idea, get that out of my head, you know. And you go along with it, and then it becomes a physical reality. It starts off with, you know, as I said. So that's the first thing Krishna's recommending Arjuna get rid of. You know, it says, when a man abandons all varieties of sense desire, which arise from mental concoction, you know, don't take shelter of the mental concoction. Anything, if some desire pops in your head, immediately you have to evaluate it according to the light of the Shastra. In case you didn't know that, that phrase, Shastra Chakshus, that's what that means. It means seeing through the eyes of the scriptures. Anything that enters your head that you're thinking, well, maybe I'll do maybe this, maybe that, immediately evaluate it in light of the Shastras. And say, and if it doesn't match up, if it's something that Shastrically is, you know, not hoyle, it's not correct, then Sarvan Partham Anogatan, get rid of it. Just say no. I ain't going there. Forget it. Okay? Then you save yourself a lot of, you know, time and trouble. A lot. So that's the point. And in the 14th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada, you know, this is like, that's the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. But that point, in case you didn't notice, Prabhupada, you know, makes these points, same points, over and over and over and over again. Just to sort of cramming into our thick heads, you know. This is so, you know, it's right throughout the Bhagavad Gita, the same points are there. But in the 14th chapter, Prabhupada, in the purport, Prabhupada, one translation in the purport, he says, one does not need this material body, and one does not have to accept the dictations of this material body. In other words, he's just once again making that point, we're not the body, so why do you don't even need this body, you know? Most people don't have a material body. When I say people, I mean I'm talking about the real people. The person is the soul. And most souls don't have a material body. You know, I quoted that. I read that thing in the last class I gave, that conversation between Prabhupada, who was here in Los Angeles, who was just up in that room up there. You know, I thought it was Dr. Stilson Judah, but the transcript says Dr. Misa or something like that. But, you know, Prabhupada said, he asked him, do all the souls fall down, you know, or do some of the souls, or are they always good? And Prabhupada said, you know, actually 10%. And then there's a pause, and then he said, actually less than 10%. So in other words, over 90% of the people, the souls, you know, don't have a material body. They're in the spiritual world. They don't have a material body. You don't need a material, we don't need a material body. The soul doesn't need a material body. Over 90% of the souls don't have material bodies right now and never have had material bodies and never will have, hopefully, material bodies. See, so it's all just external. And you don't need, we don't need a material body. We certainly don't need to accept the dictations of this material body. It's bogus. And sometimes you get realized that, well, hopefully we're all getting realization of that point all the time, but I'll give one example, like on Janmashtami. tell me if you've experienced this. I know if I've experienced this. You got to fast all day. So like around, 9 o'clock or 8:30 in the morning, my stomach starts grumbling. And I'm feeling, oh, I got to eat something. And then it kind of goes away. Then I can, goes away. Because we do a lot of half-day fast, so you got practice of that. But getting past lunch, that's the hard part. Getting past like 2 o'clock. Then, you really start feeling like, oh, I really got to eat something, and you're feeling hungry and then weak. But you really feel like, well, this is serious, and I got to better do something about this, otherwise it's going to get worse. But then, if you have a good program for that day, you got something you're doing, like something you're engaged in, and you just keep going, you drink a little water or whatever, and then it just evaporates. It just goes away. As if, like, it was just like a cloud, just was there and just, it's not there anymore. It evaporates. It's just like a mirage vanishing before your eyes. The material desires are a lot like that. There's no substance. They're not substantial. It's just some impurity. What a material desire really is, it's just like if you have like a flashlight and you put some like red plastic in front of it, then the light comes out red. Or if you put some blue plastic in front of it, then the light, if you see blue light. It's just a contamination on the pure consciousness. You see? Consciousness projected through these mental concoctions translates into it's a material desire. You see? All you have to do is just purify the consciousness. They have no substance. It's like a cloud. If you reach up, the clouds look like they're very substantial, right? When you look up in the sky and you see this big formation, oh, look at that big cloud, you see? But if you were to reach up there and try to grab it, you'd just be putting your hand through the air. You see, there's nothing to it, but it looks like it's... So material desire is like that. It seems like it's really substantial. It seems like, oh, man, this is something I really got to take seriously. I got to make sure I eat enough. Or I really got to make sure But it's just that. It's just like the cloud thing. It's just a contamination of consciousness. And that's why how we experience that when we engage seriously in devotional service. By Krishna's mercy, that contamination of the consciousness is purified and that material desire just disappears. Sometimes it works like that. Sometimes, has anybody had that experience? Probably, yeah, I'm sure everybody's had that experience. And we want that experience more, but, hopefully we've all had it a little bit. So it's just that. Which brings us to the next point. So that point was, as Prabhupada said, one does not need to accept the dictations of this material body. But and as I already touched upon, the only way to get around it, though, the only way to become free, really free, from being forced to accept the dictations of the material mind, basically, is you have to be engaged in devotional service. You see? So many people out there, they try to get free from different material desires. People try to stop smoking and drinking and this and that, and they have someone, they have associations, societies to help people do that. And sometimes they, experience a little bit of success, but it's a real struggle. I mean, they really kind of like, they're really giving it everything, mustering up all their determination. And if they just relax a little bit, sometimes they backslide and they get back into the bad habit again. Because unfortunately, there's only one way to become free from these material desires, one really effective way, and that's you got to surrender to Krishna. And Krishna says in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Daivyesh gunamai mama maya dirachaya mamevye papajate mayame tamtadati. He says this divine energy of mind consisting of the three modes of material nature is insurmountable. So in other words, this is Krishna's arrangement, this whole thing of like the material contamination which translates to the material desires, It's punishment. And the only way you can get free from that, the punishment of experiencing material desires, is you got to surrender to Krishna. Just like if you're a criminal in the jail. The only way you're going to get free from the punishment of being disciplined by the prison authorities, the warden and the guys who are there, what do they call them, the guards and this and that, is you got to start behaving yourself. When you start behaving yourself, then these guys ease up. They realize, well, okay, this guy's, he's got the point. We don't have to discipline like that. So it's the same thing. When you start behaving ourselves, which means surrendering to Krishna, engaging favorably in devotional service, then the material desires, Krishna goes, okay. And they ease up. They just start evaporating, and they're going away. And that's the only real process, the only real way to get free from the material desires. Otherwise, you're just going to be kicked around. Just like in the 3rd chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there's a verse... Nahi kaschit shanam api, jatu tishtatiya karmakrit, karyatehi avasha karma, sarva prakriti jagranai. That all men are forced to act helplessly according to the impulses born of the three modes of material nature. In other words, you have the material contamination, and you get a particular body according to the way your consciousness is contaminated. You have a particular psychophysiological makeup, and you're forced to act according to the impulses of that body, the three modes of material nature. Forced to act helps according to the impulses. No one can refrain from doing something, not even for a moment. That's Krishna's opinion there. He says, you ain't getting out of this. I'm giving you this body, and it's geared up for you to be this kind of a nature, and you're gonna have to do it. And there's only one loophole, and that is if mamevye papajante, if you surrender to Krishna, then you can transcend the modes of material nature. Anyway, in that purport, Prabhupada said, a few sentences into the purport, he says, unless one is engaged in the good work of Krishna consciousness, one will be forced to be engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy. So we should clearly understand that that's what's going on. Really clearly understand that that's what's going on. If we're not engaged in devotional service, according to the instruction of the spiritual master, just know it. Just understand that you are being engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy. Be honest with yourself. We should all understand that clearly. If we're not engaged in devotional service, you should just understand you're engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy. So, do you want to be? No. So that's why we should be engaged in devotional service. And there's another verse in the on the same point from the Bhagavatam. Dharmas venustita pumsam vikshvakshenu katasuya nodparayad yadhiratim shrama avi kevalam. I think Sudha Goswami maybe was speaking there, and he's saying that occupational duties performed by men are only so much useless labor. Shrama avi kevalam, if they do not provoke an attraction for hearing the messages of Vasudev. So in other words, you'll be engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy to no gain, no benefit. That's one of the heartbreaking things about what we see going on in the material world. You see people working hard, to no gain, to no avail. Shrama avi kevalam, it's a useless waste of time. You see? So Maya's really kind of, she's got people working like anything, striving to achieve these goals that are not worth achieving, and they don't achieve them, and they don't experience any happiness. Like yesterday, I was up at Griffith Park, up the observatory. Went up there to distribute books, and it's up on the top of this hill, so all these people come filing past us, and they go up the observatory, and then 15-20 minutes later they come filing back, and I was there from 10:30 to about 2:30, and I don't think I saw one person smiling. This is it. Here's their day off. This is supposed to be like a good time, right? And it was nice weather. It was sunny out. It wasn't too hot. And there they are. They're just, people from all over the place. Somebody's from China. The next person's from Brazil. The next person's from, this place, that place. Young, old, big, tall, fat, skinny. You name it. Every different group was a whole different thing. But invariably, they're just all... It was almost, I don't know. I almost felt like saying, "Hey, what's going on? It's supposed to be something you're doing for fun, right? So how come nobody looks happy?" But they all looked, just trudging along doing it. So anyway, that's Maya. That's the potency of Maya. She bewilders people like that. But anyway, kind of getting back to the purport here. So Prabhupada's saying that the this movement is not very difficult to understand. People must take advantage of it, for it will save them from the risky life of irresponsibility. So, So this is, this point of this is, you got to understand, this is like a very good movement. This Krishna conscious movement is a very good movement because it's really the only, we're the only show in town, so to speak, that's giving people knowledge. We're telling people, and we have been, and this movement has been telling people since Prabhupada brought it over in 1965 that, hey, everybody, you're something more than just this material body. Okay, you have a material body. I'm not trying to tell you you don't have a material body. But you're something more than just the material body. You're actually a spiritual being in a material body. And when the body finishes, the spiritual being continues to live on. And what your next situation is going to be determined by the quality of your activities during this lifetime. So, you know, might be an idea to think about what you're doing now, so that you're going to be held responsible for everything you do. Everything you're doing is being observed, evaluated, and is going to be responded to at the time of death. So, you know, so this movement is giving out that kind of knowledge to people. And there's nobody, there's no other, you know, organization out there or anything like this coming anywhere close. Now somebody might respond to that by saying, yeah, but that's just you guys. You guys think like that. You know, that's just your opinion. What is it? You know, so you have your opinion and we have our opinion. Our opinion is that we are just this material body. And then when you die, when you get old, you're sick, you die, and that's it. That's the end of everything. And that's the way it goes. That's our opinion. So why is your opinion any better than our opinion? You see? It's kind of like, you know, why is your knowledge that you're getting from your Shastra better than our knowledge that we're getting from practical observation? You know, we're seeing this is happening, and we don't see it. Okay, so then maybe we can go into the realm of observation. Anyway, what I'm getting to in this, that there is actually empiric evidence that supports this point. I mean, in one sense, it's not very important for devotees. We're satisfied with just Shabda Brahma. You know, if it's something that's stated in the scriptures, that's good enough for us, and that's good. But for the benefit of people who don't already accept the scripture, the fact of the matter is there is evidence that supports this idea that consciousness survives the death experience, and it's found in a lot of different categories of that evidence, and out-of-body experiences, near-death out-of-body experiences. Perhaps the most powerful is children remember their past lives. And I'm not going to talk about this at all. But, you know, if anybody has an interest in this kind of thing, to investigate just for the purpose of preaching or just whatever, I could tell you. I could direct you to just a few videos you could watch, which you'll just go like, wow, this is so much exactly supporting our worldview. It'll blow your mind. You know, just when you hear these guys speak, who are scientists, you know, mainstream academic people, scientists, and they're saying things like, well, you know, we feel like consciousness survives the death experience based upon, it's just like so supportive of our, consistent with our philosophy and our worldview, and it so clearly contradicts what's being said by modern science and by the other major world religions. And Suresh Krishnapu said something interesting to me the other morning. I actually was asking him to go on the YouTube and download three of these videos onto a CD. So just in case they took them down at some point, I didn't want to lose them forever. So I'll have them, and I can make, you know, duplicates of that and give them to other people or whatever. But so we were talking about that a little bit. He said to me, he said, mathematics, they have this thing where they say it's very difficult to prove something. But all it takes is one example to disprove something. So in other words, if there's a theorem, say there's a mathematical theorem, and you can come up with one solid example of showing that that theorem is incorrect, that's it. Good. Boss, finished. You've disproved that thing. All it takes is one good, solid thing to disprove that theorem. So we have it. You know, we have good, there is good empiric evidence to show that, you know, there is, consciousness does survive the death experience, that when you're dead, that's not the end of everything, or that you, when you die, you don't go to heaven or hell. See, so it's like, you know, now, does that prove Krishna consciousness? Nope. Does not. It does not. If you could come up with empiric evidence or scientifically prove reincarnation, that you've proved Krishna consciousness. You haven't. But you have something very solid that, once again, that supports and is consistent with our philosophy, and then you got to take it from there. Then the person has to be fortunate. They have to realize, well, hey, wait a second, you know, these guys are right. This does definitely, this is consistent with their philosophy. It totally contradicts what I learned as a, you know, growing up from science and these other major world religions. Why don't I give this a chance? I should give this whole way of life some serious further consideration. Doesn't that make sense? I mean, that's logical to me. I don't know if that's logical to me. This movement is something that deserves serious further consideration by any thoughtful, any unbiased, rational person, you know, if they have it presented to them properly. And then, you know, then what's that? What is that serious further consideration? You got to try the process. You got to try the chanting. You know, you got to become a vegetarian. You got to engage in, you know, study the philosophy more, chant, engage in devotional service. And that's and if you engage in devotional service, then you start experiencing a transformation in your consciousness. You start experiencing ado shada tato sadhu sangha tata bhajana kriya. Initially you have some faith. You come forward and what's going on here? What's this all about? You learn, become familiar with the philosophy. Ado shada tato sadhu sangha. You associate with the devotees. You get initiated by an elevated spiritual master. He engages you in devotional service. And then the fun starts happening. Anartha nivritti. You start becoming, as a result of doing, coming up, getting that far, engaging in, associating, engaging in devotional service, you start becoming free from your material desires. Then nishta, you start becoming fixed in devotional service. Ruchi, you start getting a taste for chanting Hare Krishna and for studying the scriptures. After ruchi is ashakti, you become further attached. That ashakti becomes, that attachment becomes stronger. Bhava, ecstatic love for God, and then praying. So it's like a scientific experiment that you perform on yourself. And then you could say to people, okay, look, you just have to do this and then judge for yourself. All right? So in other words, we really have something very, good to offer here. We're really offering, this is a really important movement. I mean, yesterday, last night, Mother Nandini Radha, she gave that presentation. And at one point, she was showing about how the cows are being treated and everything, in different parts of the world, and even in India, which is supposed to be the land of where they have this idea of holy cows. And it was like, was it abominable when she was showing that part of the scene? Yeah. It wasn't just abominable. It was insane. We have to sometimes, remind ourselves, hey, what's going on out there is not just abominable. I mean, it is abominable. It's beyond abominable. It's absolutely insane. This world is absolutely insane. The way human beings are living now, it's crazy. I'm embarrassed. I feel humiliated, actually, sometimes to be a spirit soul in a human body. And this, I feel like, wow, I really wasn't stupid to have to, get the karma to have to be born in this situation. It's ridiculous. The way, abortion, God, it's crazy. The way animals are being treated, and you can go on and on. It's just one, you can't even say just it's abominable. It's beyond that. So, we should really be serious ourselves about take this Krishna consciousness seriously. And we should, really kind of meditate and remind ourselves what an amazing opportunity this is. We're so fortunate to have come in contact with the Krishna consciousness movement. And and have this opportunity to participate. Because I was listening to one lecture and Papa was saying, he was quoting that verse, Manushyanam Sahasreshu Kaschidi. And he said, actually, in Kali Yuga, the proportion has increased. And he said, it's not Manushyanam Sahasreshu. And he made it kind of a joke. He said, Manushyanam Millionashu. So there's now, because it's Kali Yuga, back then, 5,000 years ago, when Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita, and out of many thousands among men, one main devotee of perfection. But then Papa said, but now the proportion has increased. It's out of many millions of men. So, consider yourself super fortunate. If you're here sitting in this room listening to the Srimad Bhagavatam class or you're hearing on the internet, consider yourself super fortunate because there's really only one in, maybe as Prabhupada said, millions of people, or certainly hundreds and thousands of people that get an opportunity to come in contact with the Krishna conscious movement and appreciate it and try to take advantage, to participate in it, have the opportunity to participate in it. So we should do really everything we possibly can to, we should, every day we should pray when we come, for Mangal Arati and like that. We should pray to the deities, please, protect me. Don't let me blow this. Please help me. Please protect me so that I could just stay here as a devotee for the rest of my life and keep trying to engage in devotional service. And, we should do everything we can to stay here ourselves and bring other people to Krishna consciousness. And we should also, be very confident that everything, what we have here, is perfect. We don't need anything beyond exactly what we have. Exactly what we're doing here, we don't need anything beyond that. This chapter, for instance, is an interesting example of that. Because this is, Aditi's asking her husband Kasyapa Muni, what's the process, to fulfill her desire? She wants, not revenge, but she wants to, see her sons and the demigods in general reinstated in their position of, in the heavenly planets. So, but Prabhupada, so eventually he instructs her in this Pyo Vrata process, which he was instructed by Lord Brahma. and it's described in the latter part of this chapter. But then Prabhupada, in the last purport of this chapter, he makes an interesting comment, and I'll just read it very quickly. Prabhupada says here, the Payo-vrata ceremony is performed from the first to the 13th day of the bright fortnight of the moon. But in our Krishna consciousness movement, Lord Vishnu is worshipped in every temple according to a schedule of 24 hours of engagement in performing kirtan, chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, offering palatable food to Lord Vishnu, and distributing this food to Vaishnavas and others. These are authorized activities, and if the members of the Krishna consciousness movement stick to these principles, they will achieve the same result one gains by observing the Payo-vrata ceremony. Thus, the essence of all auspicious activities, such as performing jagya, giving charity, observing vratas, undergoing austerities, is included in this Krishna consciousness movement. The members of this movement should immediately and sincerely follow the process already recommended. Of course, sacrifices meant to please Lord Vishnu, and goes on. So the point is that, you know, Prabhupada's saying here, don't have to do anything else. Don't have to perform the Payo-vrata, the Dharmadharvrata, the Jagyavalkya, you know what? No. What we're doing here is perfect. What Prabhupada has given us is absolutely perfect. And perfect for what? For us to perfect our lives. You know, we don't need, it's, you know, the morning, the program that Prabhupada gives us is what's called sacrosanct. Sacrosanct. That word means sacred and sanctified combined. Sacrosanct. In other words, we should be thinking like that. That every part of this program is not a coincidence. It's not an accident. It's Prabhupada knew exactly what he was doing, you know. And if we just follow exactly what we've been given, everything is going to be perfect. You know, perfect for our lives and anybody we're able to and get involved with this is the best thing we could do for them as well, you know. And just one last comment. Rabindranath once was like a compilation book about Mangalarti. You know, sometimes we might be thinking, I'll get up and I'll show up at greeting the deed. No, you got to understand, we have to, as much as possible, try to do it exactly the way Prabhupada gave it to us. Rise before 4 o'clock, attend Mangalarti, you know, do this, do that, hear the class, participate in the kirtan, take prasadam with the devotees, go out, do your service every day, go out on Sankirtan, you know, Harinam, just exactly the way he gave it to us, you know, and that's the highest thing, you know. But this is direct engagement in bhakti yoga, and just by doing that, you know, we're going to perfect our lives. We're really doing exactly what we need to do. We're right on target for, you know, progressing towards pure devotional service, that's the goal. I'll stop there. I can't see the time, but I have a feeling it's probably 8:15 or something. 8:25? Oh, sorry. Okay. Does anybody have any questions or comments? A volcano? No. Oh, Jagyavalkya. No, I was kind of making a joke. I was saying that, you know, we don't have to do anything other than exactly what Prabhupada's given us. Sometimes devotees kind of like get attracted to performing this austerity, that austerity. You know, not necessary. If you just focus, zero in on exactly what we're doing here, exactly the way we're doing it, that's it. There's nothing, you don't have to do anything beyond this. Just get up, come be here at the Mangalarti, chant 16 rounds, follow the 4 good principles, engage in devotional service according to the direction of your authorities, and you're on the express train going, you know, back to pure devotional service. I'm not familiar with that. I don't know anything about that. Doesn't sound like a good program to me. Anybody else? Anything? Yeah.
set it up in such a way that it's, you're not this body, you're not this body. This person came and he says, I'm doing a TV interview with a lot of different people, and I just want to know your opinion because I see you have so many books here, and I'm sure you might have some answer for this. What is the biggest problem here in the world? And I thought, yeah, okay, let me see. I said, you know what? The biggest problem in the world is identity problem.
You're right. And he goes, and Prabhupada said that.
Wow. And then he said, wow, that's very deep. I said, yeah. He said, can you give a little bit of one example? And then, you know, remember what Prabhupada said all the time in different... I said, well, just think about yourself being walking around thinking that you're Obama or you're Napoleon. Everybody will think you're crazy. So then he said, well, what about all these people here going to school? I said, well, according to our teachings, if you want to learn spirituality and you're actually thinking that you're something else that you're not supposed to be, that you're supposed to be, you're totally crazy. Please give me your address, give me the phone. Where are you guys located? He just went, you know, on and on, like he was so excited. So I was just appreciating that, you know, our literatures are full of information in any topic. We just have the time to find out, and we can give the right answer at the right time.
Yeah, great comment. Shastra Chakshus, read the books and, you know, reproduce the purports in your own language. That's perfect preaching. That's what Prabhupada told Tripurari way back in the early 70s. Anybody else, anything? Okay, thank you very much. Guntaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Like, I just want to let you know that.